BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
If, like me, you're a football fan, you'll be missing this. Sports Report, an essential part of the rhythm of the weekend. Less than 3 months ago, we were eagerly looking forward to the climax of the Premier League season, Six Nations rugby, the European Championships, Wimbledon, Test cricket and the Olympics. But as the UK went into lockdown and coronavirus took its tragic toll, the games people play and watch were one by one called off. Outside of wartime, we've never experienced anything quite like it. So I'm standing now outside the Hawthorns, home of my football team, West Bromwich Albion. It is the afternoon of Saturday, May the 2nd, and we were due to be playing Queen's Park Rangers and hoping to celebrate promotion to the Premier League. If it wasn't for coronavirus, this place would be rocking now. The PA blaring, fans singing. Latecomers thronging through the turnstiles. As it is, the gates are locked and even the normally busy Birmingham Road running alongside the ground is virtually traffic-free. It is eerily desolate. Plenty of other sports besides football have been affected too. Numerous major events have fallen by the wayside.
The International Olympic Committee has announced that the Tokyo Games, which were due to begin in July, are to be postponed by a year because of the pandemic. It's the first time the Games have ever been postponed in peacetime.
It's becoming an incredibly long list. Today, UEFA's confirmed that Euro 2020, it's not going to be Euro 2020 anymore. It's being postponed till next summer.
Let's get more news on that breaking news that Wimbledon has gone.
The England and Wales Cricket Board has moved its new tournament, the 100, to next year.
But in this edition of File on 4, it's not the events that were called off that we're interested in. It's the ones that weren't. From the Cheltenham Festival.
If you think of the best way to spread a virus, it would be bring 250,000 people together from around the country, get them crowding together to watch a horse race.
It was party time. It was like the last days of the Roman Empire. I think there was a little bit of a sense that if it was open, by goddamn, they were going to party.
To Liverpool.
Anfield consumed us, the night itself consumed us. I admit, for 90 minutes, I did not once think about the virus.
This was the week that Britain played on.
I wish to stress that at the moment, it's very important that people consider that they should, as far as possible, go about business as usual.
Boris Johnson on March the 2nd. By the time he made that speech, sports events around the world were already falling like dominoes because of coronavirus. Six Nations rugby in Dublin, the Chinese Grand Prix, football matches in the worst hit parts of Italy. On Thursday, the 5th of March, the UK's first coronavirus-linked death was reported. Yet come the weekend, in the world of UK sport, and echoing the Prime Minister, it was business as usual.
Good afternoon. Welcome. This is Saturday's Five Live Sport.
Saturday, the 7th of March, offered a mouth-watering banquet to sate any sporting appetite.
Can Liverpool avoid a third straight defeat? Arsenal still have hopes of Champions League qualification. With five of the bottom six in action, it's another huge weekend in the fight to avoid relegation. And after the football, we'll bring you England-Wales in the Six Nations.
Boris Johnson, who later nearly died from COVID-19, was at Twickenham, along with his heavily pregnant fiancée, Carrie Symonds, for the Six Nations rugby between England and Wales. There were five horse race meetings and a full football programme in England and Scotland. The only noticeable change in the Premier League was the absence of pre-match handshakes. BBC reporter Rob Nothman was covering Arsenal against West Ham, a fixture which turned out to be pivotal in the story of sport and coronavirus. In Rob's after-match interview, The main talking point was a controversial decision by the Premier League's new video review system, VAR.
The longer it was going, I was like, no, no, again, please. So happy that the VAR worked today in a positive way for us, and hopefully it can do in the future as well.
Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta talking to BBC reporter Rob Nothman.
And he was in very good spirits. Arsenal, after all, had just won the game 1-0. So he was more than happy to do an interview, was polite, showed no trace of feeling unwell or anything like that. It was just a normal after-match radio interview.
But as we'll hear later, it would turn out to be an after-match interview that unwittingly put Rob's health at risk.
With the BBC News for Gloucestershire at 1 o'clock, I'm Esme Ashcroft. A person in the Cheltenham area has become the third in the county to contract coronavirus. Gloucestershire County.
On Sunday, March the 8th, the town of Cheltenham reported its first case of COVID-19. Preparations were already underway there to receive more than 250,000 visitors for the famous racing festival due to start later that week. The Premier League continued with two high-profile fixtures, including the Manchester Derby. And Scotland hosted France in the Six Nations Rugby in Edinburgh.
It's 7 o'clock on Monday the 9th of March.
Well, I'd be considering pausing season, if it were down to me, until we know exactly where this is going and get a grip of it.
That's Andy Holt, chairman of League One football club Accrington Stanley, on the Today programme. By now, coronavirus had spread throughout Europe. All sport in Italy had been suspended. France postponed its upcoming Six Nations clash with Ireland. And Andy Holt argued that English football should now follow suit.
Because I'm walking around our club at weekend, there's 3,000 fans there, and I'm worried. You know, I'm worried that, inviting them all together at our place is actually putting them in danger. Why would I do that?
Yet over on BBC One's Breakfast News, Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden was taking a more upbeat approach.
At the moment, the advice is clear from the Chief Medical Officer. There isn't a need to cancel such events. Indeed, I was at Twickenham on Saturday with the Prime Minister. We had a huge crowd of people there. So there's no reason for people either not to attend such events or to cancel them at this stage.
Later that day, officials in Mr Dowden's department repeated the message when they met with representatives of sports governing bodies and broadcasters such as Sky and BT.
Aston Villa are at Leicester tonight with this man looking to rediscover his shooting boots.
That evening, Leicester City thrashed Aston Villa 4-0 in the Premier League in front of more than 32,000 fans. It was a very different story in Ireland. As journalist Melanie Finn flew in from Dublin for the Cheltenham Festival, she couldn't help but notice the stark contrast in approach either side of the Irish Sea.
So the Monday that I left, the country was starting to go into lockdown, even though no official guidelines had been issued in relation to that. But we had already cancelled Patrick's Day celebrations, and that in itself was huge for us. People were in shock. No one could believe that was happening. That was an indicator of how serious the Irish government was. So we flew out of Dublin Airport and it was literally like a ghost town.
What kind of contrast met you then when you arrived at Cheltenham?
Well, it was just like the racecourse organisers had said, it was business as usual. There was a growing sense of, is this the right thing to have done? What's it going to be like when all the crowds descend?
The first race already just starting to grab their positions, space at a premium, thousands below me, really excited.
Tuesday, March the 10th, thousands of racegoers started pouring into the Cheltenham racecourse for what has been described as the cup final of jump racing. Although in this case, it wasn't a cup final that lasted 90 minutes, but 4 days. Melanie Finn grew fearful at what she was seeing.
But I remember I just got to the track and I was on the coach from the hotel and I literally was just sitting there looking at all the crowds pouring in and I didn't want to get off the bus. There was just this sense of, oh dear, this could be an absolute unmitigated disaster because, you know, no one was coughing into their elbows and doing all those things that people were starting to advise that we do. And the crowds were huge.
So what kind of size of crowd are we talking about?
Well, the crowd, the first day was 60,000. I feel like they were happy to go as long as the organisers were happy to run it. So there's some people will go to Cheltenham come hell or high water. And if the racecourse chiefs were saying it was good to go, well, why wouldn't you go? You know, they've consulted with the British government. They've asked their advice and they've said, we can't let this stop our daily lives. It has to be business as usual. And anytime you did ask members of the public or members of the horse racing fraternity were the concerns about the coronavirus, it was like, no. So, you know, you were like the party pooper. They just look at you kind of baffled. And people told me, oh, you know, alcohol kills the coronavirus. Drink as many pints as you can, or you'd be better off dipping in a pint of Guinness. That was what another guy told me. And it was party town. It was like the last days of the Roman Empire. And I think there was a little bit of a sense that if it was open, by goddamn, they were going to party.
Meanwhile, as the crowds began partying in Cheltenham, Spain, France and Portugal all announced that their top flight football would be played behind closed doors. Spectators were also banned from forthcoming Champions League matches in Barcelona and Munich. But there were no such restrictions in Liverpool, which was preparing to welcome 3,000 fans from Madrid for a Champions League game. Spanish football journalist Guillaume Balaguer was scheduled to cover the match for Radio 5 Live. He recalls how Madrid, which was at the epicentre of the Spanish outbreak, was already moving into lockdown.
The day before the match, the government ordered that major sporting events should be played behind closed doors and banned indoor gatherings of more than 1,000 people. So there was not going to be football at the weekend, and they had seen enough evidence to suggest that a way in which you can catch coronavirus and how it can be transmitted very quickly was in mass gatherings, obviously information that they got from Italy, from China. So only, I think it was the day before the game, the Spanish government actually came out with a note that surprised many, because he used the word irresponsible for those that were thinking of travelling to Liverpool. As a consequence, the club Atletico Madrid also put a note out saying, you better not travel and you will be irresponsible to actually travel.
Now, this was news to me. The idea that Atletico Madrid had advised its own fans not to go to Anfield and was quoting Spanish government advice that to do so was irresponsible. That wasn't something I'd seen reported. So I went back and checked on Atletico Madrid's website. And sure enough, the warning is still there, with an offer to refund fans for their tickets if they decided not to travel. Even though Spain had already suffered 35 coronavirus deaths, most of the 3,000 Atletico fans with tickets ignored the advice and travelled anyway. The night before Liverpool against Atletico, another Spanish team, Valencia, were playing at home behind closed doors against Atalanta of Italy. The teams had met 2 weeks earlier in Milan, a match which has been described as a biological bomb responsible for spreading coronavirus throughout Italy's worst-hit region, Lombardy.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 11th of March.
The racing tips do come, of course, from Cheltenham today. 3:30, number 4, Defi du Soy. Cheltenham, 4:50, number 1.
Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, paid a visit on the second day of Cheltenham, presenting a trophy to a winning jockey. I saw her because I was there too, with my old next-door neighbour, Eric, a retired bus driver in his 70s. Like everyone else, we'd put our faith in government advice that it was safe to go. It may be entirely coincidental, but a fortnight after Cheltenham, Camilla's husband, Prince Charles, tested positive for COVID-19. Andrew McLean was working at Cheltenham at the upmarket Chez Roux restaurant. What were he and his colleagues told by the Jockey Club who organised the festival?
It was just a case of the government have allowed it to go ahead, so they're the ones in the know. They are the higher power, so as far as they were concerned, it was safe to do so. In terms of the Jockey Club, they supplied stations of hand sanitizer machines and they did send emails daily to staff members about regulations and about washing your hands and such.
For people who've never been to Cheltenham during festival week, Andrew, just tell me what it's like on the course in terms of the numbers of people, the proximity of people, and how that is for you as well as somebody who works there.
It's buzzing. It's very busy. You can barely walk anywhere. So I worked, obviously, at Shea Rue, and there was a big window, and that was looking out into, like, the Guinness bars and near the centre building, and it was just packed. It was just, like, little dots. You could barely see one person's figure because it was just so many people crowded together.
2 days into the festival, Irish journalist Melanie Finn was so concerned by what she was seeing that she asked her bosses to fly her home early.
As any journalist knows, you finish a job, and it's the first time I've ever done that, but I explained what was happening to my news desk, and they were very understanding, and they booked me and my colleagues a flight back out the next morning. And I'm not the only journalist from Ireland who left early. So I was relieved to be home, I think it's fair to say.
On that Wednesday afternoon, a major development.
The global coronavirus outbreak has been declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction.
Yet around the same time in Liverpool, around 3,000 Atletico Madrid fans were on the march to Anfield. These, remember, were supporters who would not have been allowed to attend a match in their own home city because of the virus. That same evening, Manchester City against Arsenal became the first Premier League match called off because of coronavirus. It had emerged that some Arsenal players had shaken hands a fortnight earlier with the owner of a Greek football club who had since developed the virus. As a result, those players and several members of the club's non-playing staff had gone into self-isolation. Yet there was no move to stop 3,000 supporters from the city at the epicentre of the Spanish outbreak from mingling on Merseyside in bars and restaurants.
But our commentary comes from Anfield. Pat Nevin alongside John Murray for Liverpool against Atletico Madrid.
John Murray was commentating for BBC Radio at the match.
So, you know, I've got in front of me here the official match programme from that night. Flicking through it again now, there's barely a mention apart from page 11, headline, no pre-match handshakes. UEFA announced on Sunday that players would not be shaking hands with their opponents and referees as part of the pre-match protocol, which was something that was decreed the previous weekend. Other than that, in the match programme, there's relatively little to point towards the virus.
I've been going to Anfield since I was about 11, which is 60 years. So for me, a big home match is really an unmissable event.
Dr. John Ashton, a lifelong Liverpool supporter and season ticket holder at Anfield. He's also a former regional public health director and past president of the professional body responsible for setting national standards for public health officials. On the morning of the match, he flew into Heathrow Airport.
I just returned from Bahrain, where I'd been working with the Crown Prince of Bahrain's Corona Task Force. I read the papers on the way up from Heathrow to Manchester that morning, and sometime during the afternoon, I decided this wasn't really a good idea to go to the game. I thought it was foolhardy for the game to go ahead. I think it was incomprehensible that the Madrid supporters had been allowed to travel to Liverpool and to attend the match. I realised how bad it was becoming in Spain, following on from how bad it had become in Italy. And the situation in Madrid was then beginning to glow red on the radar, really.
One of Professor Ashton's concerns was the advice given by the chief scientific advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance, who said that cancelling sporting events was not a major way to tackle the epidemic.
He argued that most transmission of the virus takes place with family and friends in close environments. John Ashton believes that shows ignorance of what big European nights are like at somewhere like Anfield.
I'm familiar with the culture of football. I'm also familiar with the culture of travelling fans. And people make a day of it or a 24 hours of it. And I know, you know, Liverpool is humming on a match day. People will be there from all over. They'll be in the bars, in the restaurants, in the hotels. People will go for a drink before the match. Then they'll meet after the match and have a post-mortem on what's happened. And, you know, this is almost tailor-made for spreading the virus.
We've discovered that concerns were also raised by Liverpool supporters group Spirit of Shankly, who were represented at a safety meeting 2 days before the match. It was chaired by Liverpool City Council and attended by the police and the football club. Liverpool City Council told us they had no powers to stop the game or prevent people travelling. Liverpool Football Club told us they were following all the guidelines.
I mean, the celebrations were some of the most raucous and physical that I've experienced.
Joel Rookwood, a lecturer in sports and health sciences at the University of Central Lancashire, believes he contracted COVID-19 that night amid the goal celebrations.
We forgot about the world's problems, that Anfield consumed us, the night itself consumed us. You still get lost on a European night. And I admit, for 90 minutes plus extra time and all that, I did not once think about the virus. People were celebrating and jumping all over each other.
Joel is 39 and normally healthy, but our interview with him took weeks to arrange because he was so unwell. Even now, more than 2 months on, he's still experiencing the symptoms.
But the evenings were certainly worse. I think my lungs, my chest would get tired from just trying to exist during the day. And I had a couple of quite nasty bouts of, with, you know, the kind of involuntary shaking that you get. And my body was obviously trying to fight the virus. I had really bad nausea, so I was having next to no food for 6 weeks. It was a liquid diet. I didn't have any solid food for 5.5 weeks.
The next 24 hours would be among the most dramatic in this unfolding story. Just after midday on Thursday, March the 12th, Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, said she would be recommending a ban on all gatherings of more than 500 people. 5 hours later, Boris Johnson disagreed. He announced that while postponing sporting fixtures was an option the Westminster government had up its sleeve, it wouldn't happen immediately. An hour later, the English Football League confirmed that the weekend's matches would continue as normal. At 9:30 p.m, the Premier League said that all its weekend matches would take place as scheduled. But around 10:15 that night,
Arsenal have just confirmed that head coach Mikel Arteta has tested positive for COVID-19. The club's London Colney training centre has been closed.
Arsenal Football Club announced that their entire first team squad had gone into self-isolation because manager Mikel Arteta had tested positive for COVID-19. BBC sports reporter Rob Nothman, who you may remember interviewed Arteta the previous weekend, was now working at the Cheltenham Festival.
We were out for a team meal that evening, and when I got back, I got a call from one of my BBC bosses telling me I was to pack up and make my way back to London, where I live. And in hindsight, that was a very wise move by the BBC.
It was no big surprise when, several days later, Rob Nothman started displaying some of the symptoms of coronavirus. High temperature, dry cough, fatigue, which in his case lasted for 7 or 8 days. As he was getting the news on that Thursday night about Mikel Arteta, Melanie Finn was back home in Dublin, recovering from her Cheltenham experience.
And then a week after that, I got sick. I had a cough, dry cough, I had a sore throat, and then a couple of days later I had quite bad chest pains, chills. I felt like I'd suddenly developed asthma, lost my sense of taste and smell, I lost half a stone, took 2 weeks off work. So Yeah, it wasn't a huge surprise. I was kind of waiting for it.
And Andrew McLean, who worked in a restaurant at the Cheltenham Festival, also fell ill.
I couldn't even walk to the bathroom without being out of breath. My fever was sky high. My cough was getting worse, and I also had a really bad tight sensation in my chest, which contributed to me not being able to breathe properly. I never felt as bad as I did then, and it was very bad.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday the 13th of March. Good morning, this is Today with Nick Robinson and Justin Wynn. And we can go to Gary, who's at Cheltenham. Morning again, Gary.
A very good morning to you from Cheltenham. The festival is continuing as planned. The famous Gold Cup is at 3:30. I'm speaking to you from...
The government has denied there was a policy of herd immunity, but their own chief scientific adviser, Sir Patrick Vallance, had other ideas. He told the Today programme...
So our aim is to try and reduce the peak, broaden the peak, not to suppress it completely. Also, because most people, the vast majority of people, get a mild illness, to build up some degree of herd immunity as well, so that more people are immune to this disease and we reduce the transmission. At the same time, we protect those who are most vulnerable from it.
Around 9:30 that morning, less than 36 hours after Liverpool's game against Atletico Madrid, a mile away across Stanley Park, their neighbours Everton were forced to close their stadium and their training ground after a player tested positive for coronavirus. An hour later, England's cricket tour to Sri Lanka was called off. And just after 11, the Premier League, which only hours before had insisted its games would go ahead, performed a U-turn and called off its weekend matches. All professional games in England and Scotland were cancelled shortly afterwards. But hey, there was still Cheltenham.
This is Cheltenham on 5 Live.
And this is Mark Chapman live at Cheltenham, where the racing does go ahead. Obviously, we've had a morning of sporting events being postponed and cancelled. The racing does go ahead here, and we will enjoy it over the next couple of hours with the 5 Live racing team. However, there is another sporting event that has gone, and it has just been announced in the last minute or so from the chairman of Augusta National. The Masters has been postponed, and also the Six Nations match between Wales and Scotland tomorrow has also just been postponed. That was announced 3 minutes ago.
Despite all the cancellations and postponements elsewhere, 68,000 people turned up for the final day of the Cheltenham Festival, Gold Cup Day, bringing the total attendance across 4 days to more than 250,000 people.
Well, I think it's just very, very difficult to comprehend, because if you think of the best way to spread a virus, it would be bring 250,000 people together from around the country, get them crowding together to watch a horse race.
Sir David King is a former chief scientific advisor under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. He's also worked with David Cameron and Theresa May. He says Cheltenham created the perfect storm to spread the virus.
Get them crowding together to put money on the bookies, get them crowding together to get their winnings. It's exactly the right forum. And afterwards, they end up going all around the country, and there they continue to spread it because there was no lockdown. I would say it was reckless. I would say it was foolhardy.
Do you think the decision to let the festival go ahead could have led to an increased number of cases of COVID-19 and possibly caused deaths that might not otherwise have occurred?
It would be very difficult not to reach that conclusion.
So is there any evidence to back up Sir David's claims about Cheltenham or that Champions League game at Anfield? File on 4 has seen data that suggests there is. It's been shared with us by Tim Spector, a professor of epidemiology at King's College in London. Tim is principal of the COVID Symptom Study, developed in collaboration with a software company called Zoe. They've devised an app designed to track the symptoms of COVID-19, which has been downloaded by more than 3 million people since launching in March. Professor Spector calls it the world's largest citizen health project, and sent us a map for late March which showed dark colouring in the areas around Cheltenham and Liverpool. I asked him to explain what it meant.
It shows hot spots in around those two areas that stood out from the surrounding areas in a way that looked significant to us, that there was an increased number of cases above what you would expect for the population and the age and social factors of that population. So when we look at the Liverpool area, we did see relatively more cases in Liverpool, for example, than in nearby Manchester, although Manchester is actually larger, probably more densely populated. And Cheltenham obviously is a less built up area, and we could see there was an increase in cases there, which would indicate that something had happened a couple of weeks before. My conclusion was that the rates of cases that followed those events 2 weeks later in the local population had been increased several fold because of those events.
So many more people contracted coronavirus in Cheltenham and in the Liverpool areas as a result of those sporting events going ahead. And potentially some of those people may have died as a result of that.
Yes, I think that's a reasonable conclusion. But association is never proof. And so when you're looking at these things, there are always other potential explanations. But certainly to my mind, that is the most logical one.
There's other evidence to support that theory too. The BBC obtained figures showing in the weeks after the festival, the highest number of hospital admissions for coronavirus in Gloucestershire came from the villages near the racecourse. At the same time, there was a surge in coronavirus cases in Liverpool too, and the city's mayor has now launched an investigation into possible links with the Atletico Madrid game. So why did those two events go ahead? The Cheltenham Festival, remember, continued for 2 days after the World Health Organization officially declared coronavirus a pandemic. Martin Fuel is Director of Communications and Corporate Affairs at the British Horse Racing Authority, which is racing's regulator.
So if I can just take you back a couple of months to the period before restrictions were imposed by the government, racing set up an industry group in February, of which the BHA was part, myself included, and we were working with colleagues from across the industry. And the whole point of that group was to coordinate racing's response to COVID-19.
Was postponing or cancelling the festival ever discussed by that group, of which you were a significant part, either before the festival or during the festival?
We made it clear that we would follow what the government's advice was. If you'll recall, and we've heard the Secretary of State say that since, the view was that there was no more risk than that attached to going to a pub or a restaurant. The Monday of that week, we went to a meeting at the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, where the principal issue was around the government's policy around mass gatherings. And the Secretary of State was really clear that Cheltenham should go ahead.
Although I have spoken to the former Chief Scientific Advisor, Sir David King, who was advising the government during the 2001 foot and mouth outbreak, when, of course, the festival was cancelled. He told us the decision to allow the festival to go ahead this year was reckless and foolhardy. And I asked him, did he think that people had become infected as a result of attending the festival, and had more people died as a result of attending the festival than would otherwise have been the case? He said it was difficult to avoid that conclusion.
I can't take issue with somebody with his scientific credentials, Adrian, you know that. But in effect, the question you're asking is whether the scientific advice the government was following at that point and then passing on to us was correct. Well, that's a question much bigger, I guess, than the actions taken by any sport, racing, football, rugby, or indeed all those leisure and entertainment facilities that were open that week. And, you know, I know everybody's reflected on it, and it's a question that the best experts in disease control need to answer at some point.
There were other major events that went ahead too, even after the fans at Cheltenham had supped their last Guinness and headed home. On Saturday, the 14th of March, boxers from around Europe gathered for an Olympic qualifier at the Copper Box Arena in London, a decision called irresponsible by the president of Turkey's Boxing Federation. And on Sunday, the All England Badminton Championships came to a conclusion after 6 days in Birmingham. It was an event that attracted 300 players and more than 25,000 spectators from around the world, including China, Malaysia, Denmark, Taiwan, India and Indonesia. The organisers, Badminton England, told us, yes, you've guessed it, they were only following government advice. It wasn't until Monday the 16th of March that the government decided to act.
From tomorrow, we will no longer be supporting mass gatherings with emergency workers in the way that we normally do. So mass gatherings, we are now moving emphatically away from.
We asked the government why they allowed these events to go ahead when so many others in Europe were being cancelled, and if they now accepted that they contributed to a spike in coronavirus cases. They wouldn't talk to us, but sent us a short statement saying their advice was based on continuous consultation with scientific and medical experts. They also said there were many factors that could influence the number of cases in a particular area. So was it a mistake to let them go ahead? A final word from Professor Tim Spector from King's College London.
Yes, I don't think there's any real doubt about that, because they'll have caused increased suffering and death that wouldn't otherwise have occurred. It was a mistake, and I think sporting events should have been shut down at least a week earlier.
This File and Fall podcast was presented by Adrian Goldberg, produced by Mick Tucker, and the editor was Carl Johnston. It was a BBC Radio Current Affairs production for BBC Sounds, where you can find more radio, music, and podcasts.